Chapter 1. Migration Patterns. In a world of 100 million immigrants, 19 million of them refugees, migration is a major social phenomenon, as it has been for thousands of years. While the drama of millions of human beings migrating across the oceans of the world has been limited to the past few centuries, when modern shipbuilding and seafaring methods have made this possible, migrations of individuals and relocations of whole peoples also took place on land and across smaller bodies of water for many centuries before that. Thus, the English of today are not indigenous to England, nor the Malays to Malaysia, nor the Turks to Turkey. Migration and conquest put them where they are. Conquest is only one of the ways in which peoples have migrated. Ahead of the conquerors, or sometimes in their wake, vast numbers of refugees may migrate to escape the carnage or the tyranny that has so often accompanied conquest. Others have migrated not of their own volition, but in bondage. Whether on land or sea, they have been shipped like merchandise to wherever others wanted them to go, Slavs across Europe and Africans across the Atlantic, among many others. Free populations have also been involuntarily moved en masse, whether by expulsions, forcible resettlements, such as the Ottoman Empire used to repopulate conquered areas with politically reliable people, or ethnic cleansing, which acquired such grim connotations in the Balkans during the last decade of the 20th century. Expulsions of Indians and Pakistanis from East Africa in the 1970s, and of fellow Africans from Nigeria in the 1980s, are part of a pattern also found in Central Europe. Deportations and evacuations, exile and forcible repatriation, compulsory transfers, and panic-stricken flight are an essential part of Central European history. The peaceful and voluntary movements we think of as immigration are just one of the ways in which the populations of the world have been redistributed over the centuries. Differences among peoples and among places lie at the heart of migrations. Moving has many and often heavy costs, including not simply the financial cost of transportation itself, or even the additional expenses that go with searching for new work and new homes. Among the heaviest costs of all are the severing of personal ties and familiar surroundings to face new economic and social uncertainties in a strange land. Great dangers have often accompanied the voyage itself, whether the dangers from storms and rough seas that sank so many wooden ships in the Atlantic during the era of sails, or the dangers that accompanied the mass exodus of the boat people from Southeast Asia in the late 20th century, when both pirates and unseaworthy vessels cost the lives of many who set out in desperation and encountered tragedy on the high seas. Such risks are not run without major differences between where people are and where they are going. The story of migration is not only about people who migrate, but also about the lands to which they go and their impacts on those lands. To understand the impact of immigrants, it is first necessary to understand the cultures they take with them from their countries of origin. Sometimes it is highly specific skills which are salient, such as skills in clockmaking among the Huguenots who migrated to Geneva in the 16th century and to London in the 17th, making both cities leading clockmaking centers of the world for the first time. Similarly, skills in optics, piano building, and beer brewing among Germans have led to German domination of one or more such industries in various countries around the world, and to domination of all of them in the United States. Sometimes it is not so much specific skills as a set of attitudes toward work and toward risk-taking which may lead the immigrants to excel in some fields in which they had no experience before immigrating, as the Chinese and Japanese have done in many countries where they began as plantation laborers, moved on to become small businessmen, and, in later generations, rose to prominence in engineering, medicine, and other unrelated fields. Cultural transplants do not always involve a simple transfer of skills and achievements, and even less often a transfer of wealth. Nothing is more common than to have poverty-stricken immigrants become prosperous in a new country, and to make that country more prosperous as well. The Chinese have done this throughout Southeast Asia, the Lebanese in West Africa, and numerous other groups in various other regions of the world. Before turning to the histories of particular migrant groups in the chapters that follow, it will be helpful in putting their experiences in context to see some of the general patterns associated with migration, and then to see how those patterns change over time. Such patterns include differences among the migrants themselves, in the circumstances from which they come, and in the changing settings in which their lives evolve. Differences among migrants. Migrants differ not only in their respective points of origin and destination and in the skills they bring, they differ also in their reasons for migrating and in such demographic characteristics as age distribution and sex ratios. Some groups acquire the culture of new lands rapidly, while others cling to their ancestral ways for generations, or in some cases, centuries. These differences are by no means always traceable to national character, for the groups that differ are often much smaller than a nation-state, though occasionally larger. For example, different groups of people from different parts of India have by no means all had the same cultural patterns abroad, any more than they have had the same cultural patterns at home. Even in the much smaller area of the British Isles, Scottish and Welsh emigrants have not followed the same occupations or had the same general experiences overseas, any more than they have in Britain itself. On the other hand, some cultural patterns transcend national boundaries, as can be seen in the histories of Germanic peoples originating both inside and outside the boundaries of Germany. Not only was there much less illiteracy in 19th century Germany than in contemporary Slavic nations, Germans living in the Russian Empire were more literate than the Slavs in that empire, and Germans in the Austrian Empire had an illiteracy rate of 6% in 1900, while Serbo-Croatians in the same empire at the same time had an illiteracy rate of 75%. Conversely, Poles living in Prussia had higher illiteracy rates than the predominantly German population there. Moreover, some cultural patterns are common not to a given race or nation, but to people from similar geographic settings, wherever those settings may be around the world. Migrations of peoples have ranged from seasonal to permanent resettlement and from local to global. The seasonal migrations of shepherds and the perpetual movements of nomads long antedated the transoceanic migrations of the modern era. Migrants have varied not only in the duration of their stays, from sojourners to settlers, they have also differed in the roles they played in the societies to which they moved. Moreover, sojourners have differed among themselves in the economic roles they have played. Some have been agricultural laborers, harvesting the crops of other lands. Some have been technicians and engineers, who have created whole industries in other countries. And one of the most striking roles of sojourners has been that of middleman minorities in countries around the world. Among the differences to be explored here and in later chapters are differences in the origins and destinations of migrants, in the geographic settings from which they come, and in which their respective cultures evolved, and the special roles played by some migrants who are sojourners or middleman minorities. Origins and destinations. Migrations tend to be selective, rather than random, in terms of skills and ambition, as well as in origins and destinations. The immigrant population from a given country living in another country is often highly atypical of the population in the country from which they came, in terms of their geographical and social origins. During the era of large-scale emigration from Sweden in the late 19th century, for example, few Swedes left their homeland from the favorably situated flatlands and forested regions of the country, while most left from regions lacking these advantages. Similarly, migration from southern Italy began in remote mountain regions with the most backward agriculture. Most of the Italian immigrants to Australia in the pre-World War II era came from areas which contained only 10% of the population of Italy. In 1979, more than half of all the migrants to the countries of the Middle East from India came from a single state, Kerala, a state containing less than 3% of India's population. Not only do immigrants often differ from the general populations of the respective countries from which they come, this selective migration is differently selective from one country to another. Thus, late 19th century immigrants to the United States from Greece and Spain were illiterate much less often than immigrants from Italy, even though illiteracy was more prevalent among the general populations of Greece and Spain than among the general population of Italy. Destinations have likewise not been random. Rather, particular destination points have tended to be linked to particular points of origin. Immigrants from particular towns in Lebanon often settled in clusters together in particular towns in Colombia. Among Lebanese immigrants to the West African nations of Sierra Leone and the Ivory Coast, there was likewise a concentration of people from particular locations in Lebanon in particular parts of the new countries where they settled. However, such patterns have not been peculiar to the Lebanese. Italian immigrants from Calabria settled in Calabrian farming communities in Australia. Italian fishermen from North Messina and Molfetta provided most of the fishermen in the Australian port of Fremantle. Italians from Stromboli created a predominantly Italian village in New Zealand. Balkan immigrants from one region of southern Dalmatia settled together in one part of Santa Cruz, California. Similar patterns of concentration have existed among Swedish immigrants in North Dakota, Macedonians settling in Toronto, and Japanese immigrants to the Philippines. Often, there have been occupational specializations accompanying regional concentrations of immigrants. For example, more than half the Greek immigrants from the Dodecanese island of Symi became fishermen in Australia, while those from Ithaca became caterers. Similarly, in Indonesia in the late 20th century, Hokkien Chinese were prominent in dealing in such products as rubber, coffee, pepper, and tobacco, while the Cantonese and Hakkas were more prominent in rice milling, lumber mills, machine shops, and soap factories. The linking of people from specific places of origin in one country to specific destinations in another has in some cases extended right down to the neighborhood level. Jewish immigrants from Poland settled in different streets on the Lower East Side of New York from the streets occupied by Jews from Russia, Hungary, or Romania, and German Jews lived in very different parts of the city from Eastern European Jews on the Lower East Side. Italians from different regions of Italy have settled in different neighborhoods, whether in Buenos Aires, Toronto, New York, or other cities. Recent Irish immigrants to Sydney, Australia, settled in different and poorer parts of the metropolitan area from those Irish immigrants who had arrived earlier. In Bombay, particular streets are occupied by people who migrated there from particular regions or even particular villages in India. Immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe and their descendants remained geographically distributed in the United States in very different regional patterns from that of the American population as a whole as late as 1980. Asian Americans were likewise distributed among the regions of the country in their own distinctive patterns. Behind such migration patterns often lay particular beginnings of a new community in a new land when one pioneering individual, family, or group of families decided to try their luck overseas. Once established, immigrants from a particular village, city, or region became sources of highly localized information about the new country, and, in the case of family members especially, often provided tangible help in moving and resettlement. Most of the Irish immigrants who left Ireland for the United States during the Great Famine of the 1840s had tickets for the voyage prepaid by family members already living in America. Many Irish immigrants to Argentina also traveled on tickets prepaid either by earlier immigrants or by prospective employers. It was once common for Lebanese businessmen in West Africa or Indian businessmen in East Africa to provide jobs for younger family members who later followed them to their new country of settlement, and Chinese businessmen have done the same in Southeast Asia. These linkages of successive waves of immigrants from particular families or communities have been called chain migration. More than 90% of the immigrants to Australia over a period of half a century came via the chain migration process. In Australia, as in the United States, letters sent back home were a major factor in others' decisions to follow in the footsteps of the early immigrants. Yet, while the majority of Southern Europeans settled in ethnic concentrations in Australia, most of these concentrations were not wholly unmixed communities, representing people from only one town or village back home. Similarly, in late 20th century New York, a cluster of immigrants from India concentrated in a few buildings, though still interspersed among other groups in the neighborhood. In these and other cases, it is not that a particular group could exclude immigrants from other countries or exclude citizens of the country in which they settled. Rather, they simply clustered together where they could. To one degree or another, however, immigrants have also tended to assimilate, first with compatriots from different parts of their country of origin, and later with members of the larger society around them in the country where they settled. Sometimes the patterns have been more complicated. Polish and other Slavic immigrants from parts of Germany, which had been taken from their ancestors by German conquerors, often followed in the wake of German immigrants, with whose language and ways they were familiar. Thus, American cities with large numbers of German immigrants, Milwaukee, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, later attracted large numbers of Polish immigrants from Prussia, who tended to settle in the German sections of town. Similarly, Eastern European Jews often settled in the midst of or adjacent to Polish immigrants, Jews from Galicia near Poles from Galicia, Jews from Lublin near Poles from Lublin, and so forth for other regions. This did not necessarily represent friendliness between Jews and Poles. On the contrary, Jews and Poles in Chicago were notoriously unfriendly toward one another, but likewise found each other commercially indispensable as tradesmen and customers, respectively, who were used to one another's methods and languages. Sometimes the pattern is more complicated in another way. After members of a given immigrant family become established in a new land, they may send for relatives who were scattered at various locations. Thus, a Greek family living in Sydney and Melbourne encouraged relatives living in Greece, Turkey, and Egypt to join them in Australia. But although those who followed were not geographically concentrated, neither was the migration random in terms of the human connections involved. Both the origins and the destinations of migrants have changed dramatically over time. Most Lebanese emigrants from the 17th century to the middle of the 19th century went either to Egypt or to European cities which had trade links to the Middle East, such as Livorno, Marseille, and Manchester. But from the second half of the 19th century on into the early years of the 20th century, Lebanese immigrants went to the Western Hemisphere, and after that, they began to migrate to colonial West Africa. Many factors were at work to produce these changes, but they did not produce randomness. Nor were the immigrants always culturally the same, even when they came from the same country. Emigrants from Syria, Lebanon, to Egypt up through the middle of the 19th century tended to be either Christians or Jews from large cities, such as Damascus and Beirut, while those who went to the Western Hemisphere in a later period tended to be Christians from mountain villages, and in a still later period, those who immigrated to West Africa were predominantly Shiite Muslims from southern Lebanon. The fact that others in their countries of destination might lump them all together as Lebanese or Syrians, or in Argentina, Turks, when the immigrants came as subjects of the Ottoman Empire, did not mean that these were the terms in which they thought of themselves or behaved toward one another. Often, the hostilities which divided them in their country of origin continued to divide them after they settled overseas, whether in Sydney, Paris, London, New York, Dakar, or Sao Paulo. It is easy enough to understand how immigrants from an agricultural background in the cold lands of Scandinavia would settle in agricultural communities in the cold lands of Minnesota or Wisconsin, or how Chetyar moneylenders from India would become moneylenders in Burma or Malaya. What is more challenging is to understand how unskilled workers from southern China would become retailers throughout Southeast Asia and in the Caribbean and North America, and how so many of their offspring would later become engineers, mathematicians, and physicians in these same countries. Without assuming predestination, we may nevertheless find clues in the geographic settings in which their cultures evolved and in the historical influences which were also at work. Geographical settings. The geography of the Mediterranean world is quite different from the geography of Southeast Asia, not only in terms of such obvious things as soil and minerals, but also in terms of rivers, mountains, climates, disease environments, and other factors whose influences limit the possibilities of different peoples in different ways. The sense of a dependable abundance, fish in the water, rice on the land, as a Thai saying has it, could hardly have been common in the Mediterranean world, where the barren hills, scanty rainfall, and thin soils made survival a struggle and made the peoples of the region renowned for their frugality. Moreover, geography cannot be thought of in two dimensions, as if we were looking down at a map or globe. While a whole region may be dominated by a particular culture, as the Middle East and North Africa have been by the Islamic culture, peoples living in mountainous parts of the same region, in Armenia or Abyssinia, for example, may preserve a very different religion and culture from that in the lower elevations. Even when Islam became the religion of the Rif Mountains of Morocco, this happened centuries after Moroccans in the lowlands had become Muslims. Similarly, the English language prevailed in the Scottish lowlands, while Gaelic continued to survive in the highlands for generations, just as the Vlach language survived in the Pindus Mountains of Greece long after Greek prevailed in the lower elevations. Mountains and uplands have in fact isolated peoples culturally and economically, from the Scottish Highlands to the highlands of colonial Ceylon, which in both cases maintained their independence for many years after their respective lowlands were conquered and incorporated into another cultural universe. Even mountainous regions nominally under the control of a larger nation or empire have not always and in all places been effectively under such control. The mountains of Montenegro under the Ottoman Empire, the Rif Mountains under Moroccan sultans, and the uplands of India under the Mughal rulers, for example. Isolation has been a key factor in both political autonomy and cultural separatism, as it has been in the enduring poverty of many mountain regions. In the Apennines Mountains of southern Italy, 91 out of 123 Lucanian villages had no roads whatsoever in 1860. In parts of the Pindus Mountains of Greece, even in the 20th century, there were places more accessible to mules and to people on foot than to wheeled vehicles, and one village acquired electricity as late as 1956. In the Rif Mountains of Morocco, snow continued to cut off some communities completely in wintertime, even in the late 20th century. The cultural isolation of mountainous communities has been partially relieved by the temporary migrations of its men to lower elevations in search of work, returning with at least a glimpse of another way of life, though the women who remained behind lacked even this. Moreover, few people from other places have come to live in these mountain villages, to present a different viewpoint. Often, the great majority of marriages have involved women and men not only from the same mountains, but from the same village. Finally, the poverty of many mountain peoples has often led them to utilize their children's labor from an early age, even at the expense of their education, thereby cutting off yet another source of a broader exposure to the outside world. Another pattern found among mountain people in various parts of the world, at least in recent centuries, has been the production of a wide variety of home-based arts and crafts during the long winter months when time is available. Swiss wood carvings, for example, have had their counterparts halfway around the world in Kashmir, as well as closer to home in Norway. Numerous other products of home-based crafts, from weaving to metalwork, have issued from mountain communities and have been sold in the international markets as items of large value in a small physical size, able to bear the high transportation costs from mountain regions. The toughness required to survive in many barren and backward mountain regions has produced renowned fighting men in many parts of the world, from the Highland Scots to the Gurkhas of India, the Albanians, the Moroccan Rifians, the Montagnards of Vietnam, and the Swiss, all formidable not only in their own homelands, but also in the service of foreign countries. The elite Scottish Highland regiments and Gurkha units of the British military forces had as counterparts the Albanians and Rifians who fought in the Ottoman armies, as well as the 50,000 to 60,000 Rifians who fought on the side of Franco during the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. It has been estimated that somewhere in the vicinity of 1 million Swiss soldiers were killed in other people's wars between the 15th and the 18th centuries. The fighting qualities of mountain men have also taken the form of local brigandage and blood feuds in their homelands. Marauders from the highlands have preyed on more prosperous communities in the lowlands for centuries, whether Kurds raiding Armenian villages, Scottish Highlanders raiding Scottish lowlanders, or similar activity in Italy, Spain, the Balkans, India, and Tibet. Feuds have also been outlets for the fighting ability of mountain men. The celebrated Hatfield and McCoy feud of the American Appalachian region was not only an example of a custom that went back to the parts of Britain from which so many southerners came, it had its counterparts in similar tribal or clan feuds in the Rif Mountains of Morocco, in the Balkan Mountains of Montenegro, in the mountains of the Caucasus, and in the mountains of Taiwan. The minerals found in some mountains present opportunities for mining and for the development of skills connected with mining. Thus, the Germans in the Harz Mountains became renowned as miners, leading to a demand for Germans to work in the mines of other countries, whether in Bohemia, Norway, Spain, the Balkans, or Mexico. However, the very fact that Germans were imported into all these countries suggests that geography presents opportunities which people are not predestined to grasp. For otherwise, all the mountains and other sources of mineral deposits in all these other countries would have led to the development of indigenous miners, obviating the necessity to import Germans. In geographical terms, mountains and highlands in general are important not only as obstacles in themselves, but also as features with both positive and negative effects on other parts of the environment. Rivers and streams flow more steadily because of the snows melting on the mountainsides, whereas their volume of water varies much more widely and more erratically where there are no mountain ranges, as in tropical Africa, where rainfall alone must sustain these waterways, or fail to sustain them. The Sierra Nevada in Spain and the Taurus Mountains in Turkey both supply the water that makes a flourishing irrigated agriculture possible on the plains below, where rainfall alone would not be sufficient. In another sense, however, uplands have a negative effect on rivers, which must plunge more sharply downward, often with rapids and waterfalls, when the streams originate at higher elevations, whether on plateaus, mountains, or foothills. Rivers with steep gradients tend to be less navigable, or not navigable at all. Mountain ranges also drastically affect rainfall patterns. When moisture-laden air blows across a mountain range, it is not uncommon for the rainfall on the side where the moisture originates to be several times as great as in the rain shadow on the other side of the mountain, where the air goes after it has lost most of its moisture while rising over the crest. The net result is that people located on different sides of a range of mountains or foothills may have very different agricultural opportunities. On some western slopes of southern Italy's Apennines Mountains, for example, the annual rainfall reaches 2,000 millimeters, while parts of the eastern slopes get as little as 300 to 500 millimeters. Similarly, in the American Pacific Northwest, precipitation on parts of the west side of the Cascade Mountains averages up to 10 times as much as on parts of the Columbia Plateau to the east. Different sides of a mountain range often have not only different amounts of rainfall, but also different slopes. This has had important military implications, where the people on one side have found it easier to climb the gentler slope and then descend upon the other side to invade their neighbors. The locations and shapes of mountain passes have also had other military, and consequently cultural, impacts. The greater ease of Roman soldiers' entry through the mountain passes into Gaul, as compared to the more difficult mountain route into German regions, meant that Roman culture reached Gaul first, and only later filtered second-hand into the lands inhabited by Germans. Coastal peoples have also tended to be culturally distinctive. In touch with more of the outside world, they have usually been more knowledgeable and more technologically and socially advanced than interior peoples. As with other geographically related social patterns, these are not racial, but locational. Sometimes the coastal peoples are racially or ethnically different, Germans being particularly represented on the coastal fringes of Russia at one time, for example. But the differences between the interior and the coastal peoples remain, even when they are both of the same racial stock. Thus, in the Middle Ages, the largely Slavic population of the Adriatic port city of Dubrovnik was culturally far more advanced in literature, architecture, and painting, as well as in modern business methods, than the Slavs of the interior hinterlands. In tropical Africa, likewise, the coastal peoples, more in touch with outside influences, were sufficiently more advanced technologically and organizationally to become enslavers of Africans farther inland. One symptom of the importance of coastal areas as cultural crossroads is that many of the lingua francas of the world have originated in such settings, whether in the Levant, on the Swahili coast of Africa, or in the ports of China and Southeast Asia. Soil, of course, has profound effects on the kinds of agriculture that is possible, and therefore on the kinds of societies that are possible. A pattern of farms that are passed down through the same family for generations is possible in fertile regions, but not in places where the soil is exhausted in a few years and has to be abandoned and a new site found while the first land recovers its fertility. Whole societies may have to be mobile when the land in any given location cannot permanently sustain them. This means that there cannot be cities and all the cultural developments facilitated by cities. Mobile slash-and-burn agriculture has been common in those parts of tropical Africa and Asia where great cities failed to develop and where the indigenous people long remained vulnerable to conquest or enslavement by peoples from more urbanized societies and larger nation-states elsewhere. In early medieval Europe as well, Slavs in east-central Europe practiced slash-and-burn agriculture, which necessitated very different forms of social organization from those which emerged after the use of the plow enabled them to create sedentary societies. Moreover, just as the nature of agriculture has influenced where urban life is or is not feasible, so the economic and technological advances associated with cities influence agriculture. Thus, in the 16th century, the hinterlands of such flourishing cities as Venice, Milan, and Genoa saw great improvements in agricultural methods introduced. Deserts and steppes, such as those of North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia, have often produced societies on the move. These nomads have included some of the great conquerors of all time. Wave after wave of conquerors from Central Asia and the Caucasus have pushed other peoples before them into Eastern and Southern Europe over the centuries, creating a chain reaction series of conquests in the Ukrainian, Polish, and Hungarian plains and in the Balkans as those displaced moved on to displace others. Less dramatic and less extreme have been the seasonal movements in places where sheep, goats, and other animals are herded in different places at different times of the year, rather than exhaust the vegetation in one place. Here, there may be permanent dwellings where the women and children stay while the men migrate seasonally with their herds, as in the Balkans. The significance of particular geographic features, mountains, rivers, climate, soil, etc., is even greater when these features are viewed in combination. For example, the effect of rainfall on agriculture depends not only on how much rainfall there is, but also on the ability of the soil to hold it. Thus, a modest amount of rainfall may be sufficient for a flourishing agriculture on the absorbent loess soils of northern China, while rain falling on the limestone soils of the Balkans may disappear rapidly underground. Similarly, the economic value of navigable waterways depends on the lands adjacent to them. Navigable rivers, which go through land without the resources for either industry or agriculture, the Amazon, for example, are of little economic value, even though navigable waterways in general have been crucial to the economic and cultural development of other regions more fully endowed with other resources. In Russia as well, waterways isolated from the major natural resources of the country, as well as from each other, cannot match the economic role of rivers which flow into one another and into the sea after passing through agriculturally or industrially productive regions. Conversely, harbors that are not as deep, not as wide, nor as well sheltered as other harbors may nevertheless become busy ports if they represent the only outlets for productive regions in the vicinity, as was the case of Genoa in northwestern Italy or Mombasa in East Africa. Similarly, the port of Dubrovnik on the Dalmatian coast, strategically located for the international trade routes of the Middle Ages, flourished despite a harbor that was not particularly impressive in itself. Sometimes a variety of favorable geographical features exist in combination within a given region, as in northwestern Europe, and sometimes virtually all are lacking, as in parts of tropical Africa, while still other parts of the world have some of these favorable features, but not others. The consequences include not only variations in economic well-being, but more fundamentally, variations in the skills and experience, the human capital, of the people themselves. Given the enormous range of combinations of geographical features, the peoples from different regions of the earth have had highly disparate opportunities to develop particular skills and work experience. International migrations then put these peoples with disparate skills, aptitudes, and outlooks in proximity to one another and in competition with one another in other lands, where they seldom have the same economic or social fate. While geographical influences may distinguish one cultural universe from another, even another located nearby, The existence of similar geographical influences and similar social patterns in distant regions of the world, marauding and feuds among mountain men, for example, means that such patterns are not national character or racial traits, but are international in scope and geographical in origin. Nor are these patterns necessarily racial characteristics, even in the limited sense of characteristics differing from one race to another for non-genetic reasons. Particular cultural universes may be largely coextensive with particular races, the Japanese culture, for example, but this is not always or inherently so. In short, geographical influences cut across national borders and racial lines, producing similar effects in different countries and different effects in various regions of the same country or among culturally different members of the same race. This is not to say that there are no national cultural influences. Clearly there are. Language, religion, and political traditions are just some of the cultural values holding together nations composed of peoples subjected to disparate other influences. The point here is simply that a recognition of distinct cultural patterns, whether originating in geography, history, or otherwise, is not the same as a belief in national character or racial traits. These things may overlap or even be congruent in some cases, but they may also be quite separate. While continents or other regions of the world may not be geographically unique nor homogeneous within themselves, nevertheless, the ensemble of geographical influences operating in one region of the world has differed significantly from the geographical and other influences operating elsewhere. These differences are not confined to their original locations, but are also embedded in the cultures of peoples migrating from these different regions of the world. One of the more geographically fortunate parts of the world, in terms of having the natural resources needed for the development of a modern industrial economy, has been northern and western Europe. Iron ore and coal deposits, the key ingredients of steel manufacturing and the heavy industry dependent on it, are concentrated in the Ruhr Valley, in Wales, in Sweden, and in the region so bitterly fought over by France and Germany, Alsace-Lorraine. The broad coastal plains of northern Europe have also provided the peoples of that region with much prime agricultural land and with navigable rivers crisscrossing these lands, knitting large areas together economically and culturally. The fact that Europe has many peninsulas, islands, and numerous harbors gives the continent excellent access to the sea. The Gulf Stream warms Western Europe to give it milder winters than places at similar latitudes in the Western Hemisphere or in Asia. London, for example, is farther north than any place in the 48 contiguous United States, yet it has milder winters than New York City, much less cities in Minnesota or Wisconsin. Eastern, Central, and Mediterranean Europe do not share all these advantages. The Gulf Stream's influence on the climate of European nations on the Atlantic becomes progressively less in the more distant central and eastern portions of the continent, where rivers are frozen for more days of the year and where winters are longer and more bitterly cold. The natural resources required for modern industry are also less abundant and in many places virtually non-existent in Central and Eastern Europe. The broad coastal plains of Northern Europe have no counterparts in the Balkans, where hills and mountains come down close to the sea, and the coastal harbors often have no navigable rivers to link them to the hinterlands. Spain has likewise been lacking in navigable rivers, and Sicily lacking in both rivers and rainfall. These sharp differences in geographical advantages have been reflected not only in great disparities in wealth among the different regions of Europe, but also in similarly large differences in skills, industrial experience, and whole ways of life among the peoples of these regions. Thus, when the peoples of the Mediterranean migrated to the United States or to Australia, for example, they did not bring with them the industrial skills or the whole modern way of life found among German or English immigrants. What they did bring with them was a frugality born of centuries of struggle for survival in the less productive lands and waters of the Mediterranean, and a power of endurance and persistence born of these same circumstances. The ability of the Italian immigrants to endure poor and cramped living conditions and to save out of very low wages, which caused comment among those around them, whether in other European countries or in the Western Hemisphere or Australia, had both geographical and historical roots. Similar characteristics have marked various other Mediterranean peoples, but the Italians are a particularly interesting group to study because they include not only the Mediterranean people of the south, but also people from the industrial world of the Po River Valley in the north, whose geographical, economic, and cultural characteristics are much more similar to those found among northern and western Europeans. The enduring consequences of the different skills and experiences possessed by people from different parts of Europe can be seen in the fact that the average income of immigrants from southern and eastern Europe to the United States in the early 20th century was equal to what was earned by the bottom 15% among immigrants from England, Scotland, Holland, or Norway. Illiteracy was higher among immigrants from southern and eastern Europe. In school, their children tended to lag behind the children of either native-born Americans or the children of immigrants from northern and western Europe, and their IQ scores were often very similar to those of American blacks and were sometimes lower. Nor was all this peculiar to American society. In pre-World War II Australia, immigrants from southern Italy, Dalmatia, Macedonia, and the Greek countryside were typically illiterate and spoke primarily their local dialects rather than the official languages of their respective home countries. More than three-quarters of these southern European immigrants to Australia were from the rugged hills or mountains, the steep coastlines or islands of the region, rather than from the urban areas or plains. Although these remote areas were eventually drawn into the modern world, the skills of their peoples continued to lag behind the skills of peoples in other parts of Europe that were more industrially advanced, and this was reflected in their earnings in Australia, as in the United States. As late as the 1970s, the median earnings of immigrants to Australia from Greece, Italy, or Yugoslavia fell below the earnings of immigrants from West Germany or from English-speaking countries. Southern Europeans in Australia remained underrepresented in professional and technical occupations, and from nearly half among the Italian immigrants to an absolute majority among the Greek and Yugoslavian immigrants were unskilled laborers. Asia has likewise had sharp cultural divisions, many growing out of its geography. The world's highest mountain range, the Himalayas, have separated Asia's two great ancient civilizations, those of China and India, which developed independently of one another to a greater extent than any of the civilizations of Europe or the Middle East. China, in particular, was a world of its own, and clearly the most advanced nation on earth for many centuries. One sign of its preeminence was that Chinese goods were for long in great demand in Europe, while Europe had nothing to offer in return except gold and silver. The compass was in use in China's maritime trade decades before it was introduced to Europeans by the Arabs, and books were printed in China centuries before the Gutenberg Bible was printed in Europe. Chinese silks and porcelain were in demand in Asia, Europe, and Africa. While Chinese culture had a major impact on the cultures of Korea and Japan, and an influence felt as far away as Persia and Russia, there were few external cultural influences on China itself from the 8th through the 13th centuries. Yet very little of China's culture was spread by migration, certainly nothing to compare with the later massive spread of European culture to the Western Hemisphere, not only by the movement of millions of Europeans, but also by the Europeanization of both the indigenous populations of the Western Hemisphere and the millions of descendants of Africans brought to the New World. The Japanese are a reminder that a meager natural resource base alone is not enough to prevent industrial development, though it may prevent such development from arising spontaneously from within the given society. Japan's industrialization was transplanted from Western Europe, notably England and Scotland, and from the United States, as a result of deliberate decisions made by the Japanese government amid a national fervor to catch up with the West. Why this happened in Japan, but not in India, Abyssinia, or the Balkans, is a profound question, with few answers or even systematic explorations. Many centuries earlier, Japan was likewise very receptive to cultural and technological imports from China, which at that point represented the most advanced culture in the world. In short, geography is a major influence, but not a predestination. Otherwise, nations like Japan and Switzerland would be among the poorer nations of the world, instead of among the most prosperous. Even after large numbers of Chinese, Japanese, and Indians migrated to other countries around the world, the cultures they took with them had little or no effect on others outside their own respective groups. To a greater or lesser extent, these migrants from Asia tended to assimilate at least the outward veneer of the Western societies in which they settled, though retaining their own work patterns and discipline, which enabled them to rise to prosperity in these countries. The southwestern part of Asia, known as the Middle East, has also sent abroad migrants whose cultural endowments reflect the geographical circumstances in which their societies evolved. Lacking both the spontaneous abundance of food found in parts of the tropics and the natural resources for modern industry found in Northern Europe, the peoples of the Middle East have historically had to struggle to make a living, whether in the nomadic pattern of the Bedouins of the desert, or in the irrigated farming of others, or, perhaps most striking of all, in the middleman traders who originated in this region and spread throughout the world. The economically strategic location of the Middle East, for centuries a crossroads of trade between Europe and Asia, fostered the development of many trading ports and many trading peoples, of whom the Jews, the Armenians, and the Lebanese have been particularly prominent, not only in the Middle East itself, but also in other countries on every inhabited continent. These kinds of immigrants, middleman minorities, from this part of the world, have had patterns of skills and aptitudes strikingly similar to those of the overseas Chinese, who originated in similarly demanding regions of southern China, where trade was part of their survival skills in a geographically unpromising region for industry, but which had trading ports. Duration of migrations. Migrations are not always permanent resettlements. Their duration may last from a few months to a few years to many generations. From ancient to modern times, shepherds have migrated with their flocks to summer grazing grounds and returned home for the harvest and to shelter in the winter. Agricultural laborers have likewise moved with the seasons, whether in their homelands, in neighboring countries, or from the northern to the southern hemisphere, taking advantage of the reversal of the seasons to find work during two growing seasons in one year. Mountain men, whether in the French Alps and Central Massif, or in the mountains of Switzerland or Austria, often left for the winter to work in the cities to supplement the meager incomes of their families. It was said of the high regions of the French province of Auvergne that the subsistence of half the population is dependent on the seasonal migration of the other half. Similarly, migrants from northern Italy often left in the spring to work in other countries before returning home in the fall, the Lombards going to Switzerland, the Venetians to Austria, and the Piedmontese to France. Nor were these regional migrations within Europe incidental. More Italians migrated within Europe than migrated across the Atlantic to the United States until late in the 19th century. There were also long-established seasonal migration patterns in Central and Eastern Europe, with Polish women and children, for example, moving into the eastern region of Germany to work in the sugar beet fields there. The topography and technological backwardness of the Balkans kept many of its poor from joining these international migrations until the latter part of the 19th century, when railroads finally reached into parts of this region, the first railroad reaching Serbia in 1878. However, the seasonal migrations of Eastern and Central Europe long antedated the railroad, the plains of that region being accessible by wagon or even on foot, unlike the rugged terrain of the Balkans. Sojourners have not been limited to those who migrate for a season. Those working in commerce or industry usually have no reason to coordinate the length of their stay with the seasons and may remain abroad for whatever number of years is needed to accomplish their purposes. Migrants who have been sojourners, rather than settlers, have included technicians, engineers, and businessmen who spread modern industrial knowledge and techniques from Britain to Japan in the 19th century, from Western Europe and the United States to Russia under both the Tsars and the Communists, and from Britain, France, and Germany to Argentina. Other sojourners have included the small retailers and other middleman minorities from China or Lebanon, who long followed a pattern of spending their working years abroad and returning home in old age to retire, until their homelands became places to which fewer and fewer wished to return, whether because of oppression or violence. However sharp the distinction between sojourners and settlers may be in principle, difficulties arise in applying that distinction in practice when plans to sojourn or to settle change as a result of either external changes or changing dispositions on the part of the immigrants themselves. When Chinese and Lebanese sojourners found themselves stranded overseas after their respective homelands became places to which they no longer wished to return, they became settlers involuntarily, whether in the countries to which they had initially immigrated or in some other country to which they moved later. Maronite Christians among the Lebanese immigrants in Sierra Leone, for example, began to retire to Ireland in their older years as a result of their contacts with Irish priests working as missionaries in Sierra Leone. Conversely, immigrants who initially intended to settle may return to their homelands or re-emigrate to another country if disappointed in their hopes. Others, however, clearly intended from the outset to return, as shown by such things as men leaving their wives and children behind, or by very high rates of saving while abroad, as among Sicilians, for example. Sojourners and returnees have often had major economic impacts on their countries of origin. Pakistan received 9% of its gross national product in 1981 from the remittances of its nationals working overseas, and financed 86% of its trade deficit with those remittances. Altogether, Asian migrants working in the Middle East alone remitted more than $7 billion to their respective homelands in 1980. Most of these were young males with wives and other dependents left at home, obviously sojourners. In this case, the sojourners have also had a major impact in the countries to which they migrated, constituting 80 to 90% of the total labor force in Kuwait, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. In other countries as well, remittances from abroad have been major items in their financial ledgers. As of 1979, remittances brought in 70% as much money as exports from Portugal, 80% as much as exports from Turkey, 93% as much as exports from Egypt, and 26% more than all exports from Jordan. As one study of this phenomenon concludes, it is hard to imagine a mechanism for the transfer of so much capital to so many and often poor countries and to the benefit of so many of their citizens. Moreover, most of these remitters tended to be unskilled or semi-skilled workers, so that these benefits accrued to working-class families rather than to elites, as foreign aid has so often tended to do. As of the late 1980s, remittances worldwide were greater than all the foreign aid dispensed by all the various governmental agencies around the world. Returnees not only bring back money, but can also bring back new skills and changed attitudes. Stories of Italian immigrants returning home, arrayed like signori, have been repeated among other immigrants in other countries, such as the Jains, who returned to the state of Gujarat in India to live in a conspicuously prosperous lifestyle there, producing resentment among other Jains, as Italian returnees were likewise resented in Italy. Sometimes returnees have settled in enclaves with other returnees, whether in Italy or in India, perhaps a reflection of changed attitudes as much as a more prosperous lifestyle. For example, despite the low priority given to formal education in southern Italy, Italian emigrants returning home often showed much more interest in getting their children educated. A study of Italian emigrants in the latter half of the 20th century concluded, "Today in southern Italy, there is scarcely a village where a large percentage, often a majority, of the landowners are not returnees from the United States." Even more revealing is that one of the first acts of thousands upon thousands of Italian immigrants was to seek the best opportunities available by sending their children to institutions of higher education in Italy. My studies in southern Italian villages have shown that one of the most striking effects of emigration has been the creation of a vast army of teachers, lawyers, physicians, and other professionals who, their training paid for by the proceeds of their immigrant father's toil in America, have contributed a big share to the swelling middle class in Italian society. Such advancement was, of course, not true of all immigrants, Italian or otherwise. Some returned as failures, and some returned to resume the life they had led before. Given the greater propensity of poorer and less skilled people to migrate, whether as settlers or sojourners, it can hardly be surprising that many worked in lower-level occupations abroad and had no higher skills upon returning. Moreover, those intending from the outset to return home had little reason to acculturate to the society to which they went, even when they had the initiative and ambition to work very hard and save for the benefit of their families. The situation facing Greek emigrants who went to industrialized northwestern Europe may be indicative. The migrants were willing to take up any well-paid job, irrespective of its prospects for promotion or for occupational training. Furthermore, the low level of schooling of most of the migrants did not allow them to avail themselves of the numerous educational and occupational training opportunities in the host country. Moreover, the migrants were willing to work long overtime hours and were left with little time and energy to improve themselves. Some skills acquired by migrants in highly specialized industrial processes are in low demand in Greece due to the relatively low level of technology prevailing. Many returnees do not like to work in the Greek manufacturing industry, where wages are about one-half of what they were earning abroad. Returnees with skills often prefer self-employment anyway, and do so in occupations and pursuits where their acquired skills have little usefulness. Also, it must be observed that returnees tend to revert quickly to the somewhat relaxed approach to work characterizing the domestic labor force. These differing pictures of returnees need not contradict each other or even be indicative of differences between Italians and Greeks. Both patterns could undoubtedly be found in many countries, but seldom were returnees worse off than before they left. Those who returned with nothing more than their savings from abroad to resume the life they left were better off for being able to afford things they could not have afforded before, as well as for whatever insights they may have gleaned from their glimpses of another way of life. Among Greek sojourners, most came from an agricultural background in Greece, but did not return to agriculture when they were repatriated. In addition to becoming more urbanized after living abroad, Greek returnees also tended to display changed attitudes toward family life, religion, and political issues. Such modest improvements as better housing and a somewhat higher standard of living are not small things to people escaping from poverty. One study found that 22% of returning Pakistani migrants' savings went into the purchase or building of a house, while among returnees to Thailand, 60% went for that purpose. Among returnees to Bangladesh, 6% of their savings went toward establishing a business, as did 23% of the savings of Sri Lankan returnees. Genuine returnees must be distinguished from immigrants who are only figuratively returning by going to a land whence their ancestors once emigrated. Millions of Germans who had settled in Eastern and Southeastern Europe over a period of centuries were expelled from these regions after World War II by nations reacting against the bitter experience of their wartime occupation by Nazi armies. Vast numbers of ethnic Germans thus returned to a country that they had never seen. The mass expulsions of Indians and Pakistanis from East Africa in the post-independence era were likewise represented politically as sending people back to their homelands, when in fact many had been born where they lived, never saw their ancestral homelands, and in many cases resettled in Britain rather than on the Indian subcontinent. Early 19th century American schemes to send slaves back to Africa were also attempts to return people to places they had never seen and which their parents and grandparents had never seen. While these back to Africa schemes were never carried out on the scale envisioned, some free blacks from the United States were in fact settled in Liberia, where their foreignness was painfully demonstrated by their lack of biological resistance to African diseases, which accordingly created a high death toll among them. Migration is not always a once-and-for-all process, even for those who leave their homelands never to return. They may migrate from one foreign country to another before finally settling down. Most Polish immigrants to the United States, for example, lived outside of Poland before settling on American soil, and many Southern Europeans lived outside their native lands before settling in Australia. Some entrepreneurial refugees from communist North Korea settled first in South Korea, then in Latin America, and finally in the United States. The story of migration is often also a story of remigration. These repeated relocations also test the persistence of a group's culture in very different settings. The many large-scale relocations of Jews over many centuries, for example, has not destroyed either their cultural heritage or their cohesiveness, though both have been modified in the process. The migrations of conquerors, refugees, slaves, and sojourners have been outstripped by the migrations of those going to settle permanently in a new land. However, even during the era of mass migrations across oceans during the past century and a half, vast numbers of people have continued to return home. It has been estimated that between the mid-1830s and the late 1930s, approximately 30 million people left the Indian subcontinent and nearly 24 million returned, even though these Indians were scattered across thousands of miles of ocean from the South Pacific to the Caribbean to East Africa. At the other end of the spectrum, refugees seldom return, whether they have fled from famine, as among the Irish in the 1840s, or from persecution and mob violence, as among the Jews from Eastern Europe, beginning in the 1880s. Thus, during the early 20th century, fewer than 10% of the Irish and Jewish immigrants to the United States returned, compared to about 60% of the Southern Italian, Croatian, and Slovenian immigrants to the United States who returned home during the same era. In the last decade of the 20th century, the return flow of immigrants to Hong Kong was only 6% of those leaving, again, a refugee movement in anticipation of China's takeover of the colony in 1997. The widely varying reasons for migration have been reflected in very different patterns among the migrants. Refugees tend to be a relatively representative sample of the population from which they come, as far as age, sex, and other demographic characteristics are concerned, while sojourners are often predominantly male and predominantly young adults. During the era of mass emigration from China, Japan, and Italy, male emigrants outnumbered female emigrants several times over, whether their destinations were the United States, Latin America, Asia, or Australia. Where a migration begins to change in character from one of sojourning to one of permanent settlement, the sex ratio typically begins to shift, sometimes dramatically, toward one of male-female balance. The earlier male predominance among the immigrant group may be followed by female majorities among later immigrants, and, of course, sex-balanced offspring among descendants of the immigrants who are born in the new land. Sometimes the movement toward a balancing of the sexes is aided by a higher rate of return home among males still following the sojourning pattern, while females tend to stay. Often the females are the wives of those men who have decided to remain, whether or not that was their original intention, and who therefore send for their families to join them. Among groups where arranged marriages have been common, the women who migrate may be joining fiancés whom they marry upon arrival. This was once common among Japanese immigrants to Canada and the United States, and was not unknown among Italian immigrants to Australia, especially for those men who could not afford a long trip back to Italy to find a bride. While refugees are, in principle, distinguishable from sojourners or other kinds of migrants, in practice, this distinction has often been difficult to make. This has been especially so in the late 20th century, when national and international policies designed to provide humane access to other countries for refugees have been taken advantage of by people declaring themselves to be refugees from persecution in order to circumvent immigration laws. Professional smugglers of illegal immigrants have included among their services briefing these immigrants on the fabrication of stories to tell in order to gain asylum. Moreover, even freelance illegal immigrants often know that representing themselves as refugees increases their chances of being allowed to stay. The losers in this process include the legitimate immigrants and refugees who may find their access restricted as a result of the political backlash against other immigrants who abuse the trust and generosity of the receiving country. Middleman minorities. A special kind of migrant has been the middleman minority. These include retailers, ranging from pushcart peddlers to international merchants, and moneylenders, ranging from pawnbrokers and petty loan sharks to international financiers. Usually, there are far fewer people at the higher levels of all these occupations than at the elementary levels, requiring less money, experience, or sophistication. However, even modest prosperity among middlemen minorities may be resented far more than real opulence among some other groups, such as nobility or entertainers, and those relatively few members of middleman minorities who achieve genuine wealth tend to be regarded as representative rather than exceptional. In one way or another, middlemen facilitate the movement of goods from the producer to the consumer without necessarily physically producing anything themselves. Middleman minorities do this in communities where others are a majority of the population, whether in a particular ethnic enclave or in whole nations. For this to be a viable and lasting role, there must be some cultural difference between the middlemen and those they serve. Otherwise, each community or nation would supply its own middlemen. But however large the role of racial and cultural differences in the histories of middleman minorities, this group of minorities does not represent a particular race or a particular culture. Some are Africans, like the Igbos of Nigeria. Some are Middle Eastern, like the Lebanese and the Armenians, and some are Asians, though different races of Asians, like the overseas Chinese and the overseas Indians. The best known of the middlemen minorities, the Jews, include both European and Middle Eastern peoples. Culturally, these various groups differ from one another in language, food, music, and social customs. Only when cultures are defined more narrowly in terms of work skills and work habits, as well as the fortitude needed to take on the demanding role of middleman minority, do these otherwise disparate groups show similarities. What they have in common is a particular kind of human capital, as economists call the experience and knowledge used in economic activity. Frictions that are all too familiar in intergroup relations tend to become extreme in the case of hostility toward middleman minorities. The word pogrom has often been used to characterize episodes of mob violence and atrocities that broke out against the Jews of Europe at various times in their history. However, the same kind of vindictive terror has been inflicted on other middleman minorities in countries around the world. The Igbos in Nigeria, Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, Tamils in Sri Lanka, and Chinese in Southeast Asia have likewise been on the receiving end of such inhuman treatment. In a horrifying contemporary example, a Tamil woman picked at random was dragged off a bus in Sri Lanka, doused with gasoline, and set ablaze by a Sinhalese mob in which people danced and clapped their hands while she died in agony. During intergroup violence in Nigeria in 1966, tens of thousands of Igbos were slaughtered indiscriminately by mobs. Back in 1895, Turkish mobs likewise massacred Armenians, including 3,000 men, women, and children who fled to a cathedral for refuge and were burned alive inside when the cathedral was set on fire with 30 cans of petroleum. What all these victims had in common was that they represented middleman minorities in these respective nations. Not all were personally engaged in middleman occupations, but members of the surrounding population were most likely to encounter people of their ethnic group in that role, even if a majority of the Tamils, Igbos, or Armenians worked less conspicuously in other occupations. What is there about middleman minorities that provokes such venomous hostility? Other kinds of racial or ethnic minorities have also faced varying degrees of hostility, whether they were immigrants or descendants of slaves or of conquered indigenous people. Yet none of these other minorities has so often and on such a scale faced lethal mob violence. Tens of thousands of Igbos were slaughtered by their fellow Nigerians. The number of Armenians slaughtered in the Ottoman Empire was more than 1 million, and Jews on many occasions over the centuries were slaughtered en masse by frenzied mobs in Europe, even before the government-controlled Nazi Holocaust claimed 6 million Jewish victims. Moreover, middleman minorities have seldom been violent people themselves who might have initiated hostilities. While hatred and even violence against various kinds of minorities have been all too widespread throughout history and in many regions of the world, this alone cannot explain the special kind or intensity of hatred and violence directed against middleman minorities. Perhaps what intensifies the feelings against them is that they perform economic functions which have been much misunderstood and condemned throughout history, regardless of who has performed these functions. Moreover, the social isolation of middleman minorities, clannishness is a phrase often used, makes it easy for others to imagine the worst about them, and for skilled demagogues to play on that imagination to arouse the public to a frenzy of hatred against them. While his economic functions define the middleman minority usually exists where the local population does not provide its own middleman, for one reason or another. It may be simply that such occupations do not attract many people from the local population. Often, however, local middlemen are simply not able to meet the competition from groups long experienced in such occupations. In Argentina, for example, native Argentine store owners found themselves losing business to Jewish immigrants, charging lower prices and advancing credit to customers who before had to pay cash. Simply imitating the practices of the Jews was much easier said than done. To operate on a thinner profit margin required both finer calculation and a willingness to live on a lower economic level, at least until a large enough clientele could be attracted to offset the lower profit per item by a larger volume of business. Advancing credit also required a shrewd sense of when to lend, to whom, how much, and on what conditions. Here, too, experience was indispensable, as well as a close knowledge of local individuals gained by observation and interaction. Groups with generations or centuries of experience as middleman minorities obviously have many advantages in this demanding field, where shrewd understanding, hard work, long hours, and inescapable risks are the norm, and where bankruptcy is seldom far away for those who get careless. While Jews are the most famous of the middleman minorities, so that others are analogized to them, the overseas Chinese as the Jews of Southeast Asia, the Lebanese as the Jews of West Africa, Parsis as the Jews of India, etc., Jews are in fact not the most numerous of the world's middleman minorities, nor are most Jews in such occupations in most countries today. Historically, however, Jews have been disproportionately concentrated in middleman occupations, going back at least as far as the times when Jewish peddlers followed in the wake of the Roman legions, selling to the peoples of the conquered lands. In more recent centuries and more open societies, Jews and other middleman minorities, after securing themselves financially through their earnings from business, have tended to educate their children for the professions. But even before reaching that stage, middleman minorities have often also had skills in various kinds of production, such as shoemaking, textile and clothing manufacturing, gem cutting, or the work of gold or silversmiths. These occupations are not middleman functions as such, though they are functions into which some middlemen have branched out, again, the Jews being the most notable example, but by no means the only or most numerous examples. Middleman minorities, such as the Parsis and Marwaris of India, for example, have likewise been prominent in the history of the textile industry in that country, and the Lebanese have maintained an international network of textile dealers centered in Manchester, England. In 18th century Russia, Armenians owned 209 of the 250 cloth factories in the province of Astrakhan. Very similar patterns can be found among the overseas Chinese concentrated in Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and other countries of Southeast Asia, but following similar occupational patterns as far away as the Caribbean. They have not only been middlemen in such occupations as retailers and pawnbrokers, but have also branched out to become manufacturers of products ranging from clothing to computers. The overseas Chinese are the largest of the middleman minorities, consisting of about 36 million people scattered around the world, more than twice the entire Jewish population of the world. As will be seen in Chapter 5, the overseas Chinese have played a major role in the creation of businesses throughout Southeast Asia and elsewhere, and have played an even larger role in the economies of that region than the Jews have played in the economies of Europe or the Western Hemisphere. It has not been uncommon at various periods of history for the Chinese minority in Southeast Asia, only about 10% of the population of that region, to own and operate a majority of the businesses in whole industries in Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, or Indonesia. Most of these enterprises have been of modest size and typically family-run operations, but the overseas Chinese dominance is felt as well in large corporations, where even international conglomerates are often family-run. Many other middleman minorities have dominated local commerce in particular regions of the world, such as the Indians and Pakistanis throughout East Africa, the Greeks and Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, Igbos in northern Nigeria, Koreans in black ghettos in the United States, and the Lebanese in numerous countries. Sometimes that dominance continues on into the present day, but in other cases these historical patterns have faded with time, or the people themselves have been expelled en masse, a fate all too common in various countries of Europe, Asia, and Africa, for the hostility encountered by middleman minorities has been as striking and widespread as their success in rising from humble beginnings to at least modest prosperity and sometimes real riches for some in their ranks. By the late 20th century, when Thailand and Indonesia together had 5 billionaires, all 5 were overseas Chinese. But seldom have middleman minorities begun their careers in a community or a country by bringing wealth with them. Almost invariably, they have created wealth, both for themselves and for the society around them, often creating not only particular businesses, but in some cases whole industries and functions that did not exist before. Beginning often in poverty, middleman minorities have historically been hawkers and peddlers on a mass scale, for example, Jews in 19th century America and Argentina, and the Lebanese in South Australia, West Africa, and in many parts of the Western Hemisphere. It is from such humble beginnings that there ultimately emerged such businesses as Bloomingdale's, Hagar Slacks, and Levi's. Most peddlers, of course, never reached such economic heights, but many moved up to have their own stores, and some eventually chains of stores. Middleman minorities have typically been urban people, even in agricultural societies. Often, an absolute majority of them living in a given country have concentrated in a single city. Thus, studies during the 1980s showed that most of the Lebanese in France lived in Paris, and most of those in the Ivory Coast lived in Abidjan, while three-quarters of the Lebanese in Australia lived in Sydney. The great majority of the Parsis in India settled in Bombay. Most of the 19th century Jewish immigrants to the United States settled in New York City, while in early 19th century Australia, more than two-thirds of the Jews in the colony of New South Wales lived in Sydney, and in Argentina, most lived in Buenos Aires. Most of the Chinese living in Peru lived in Lima, while most of those in Argentina lived in Buenos Aires. The occupations of middleman minorities may explain their high degree of urbanization, but their high levels of concentration in one or a few cities in each country suggests a social need for contact with compatriots, at least during the early generations of immigration. With the passage of time and the acculturation of later generations to the world of the host society, these concentrations tend to lessen, just as concentration in middleman occupations tends to decrease as later generations go into their professions. In predominantly agricultural societies, middleman minorities have often financed the growing of peasants' crops, as the Chetyars from India once did in Burma, and as the overseas Chinese did in Thailand and Malaysia. Indigenous farmers in East Africa, in what is now Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, were drawn into the world market by people from the Indian subcontinent who lent them money and purchased and marketed their crops. Modern transportation came to much of that region as a result of trucks owned and driven by Indians. Despite these and other contributions of middleman minorities to the societies around them, they have often been seen as mere parasites who play no useful role in the economy. The uselessness of middlemen is a theme found among European colonial rulers in Asia and Africa, among the intellectuals and the ignorant, the religious and the secular. To make money from the mere transference of a physically unchanged product from the producer to the consumer stinks of sorcery to the economically uninitiated, according to F.A. Hayek, and for a moneylender to demand more money back than he lent has been condemned by all three of the great religions that emerged from the Middle East, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Even in the absence of racial or religious differences between middlemen and their customers, hostility to informal middleman activity arose in a World War II prisoner of war camp, much to the dismay of an economist among the prisoners. Clearly, the middleman could be easily circumvented if all that he did was to insert himself gratuitously between the producer and the ultimate consumer. Producers could simply open their own retail outlets, or consumers could buy directly from the factory. Only where the costs and risks of these alternatives exceed what it would cost to use a middleman is the middleman able to sell and survive. The costs and risks are lower for the middleman simply because he is specialized and experienced in managing inventories, in dealing with customers, and in the other functions he performs. The middleman is also better able to advance credit to many low-income customers, simply because he knows them individually and at closer range than a distant manufacturing corporation or government bureau can. In short, the middleman lowers the costs of economic transactions for all concerned. Otherwise, either the customers or the manufacturers, or probably both, would take their business elsewhere. The belief that middlemen are useless parasites has been tested empirically in different parts of the world and in various periods of history, when governments have expelled some middleman minority en masse. Only after prices and interest rates have risen in the wake of such actions, and in some cases the economy in general has collapsed, has it then become clear just what the middlemen contributed. However, even such painful lessons in economics have not always caused political reevaluations, much less reversals of policy, though there have been instances where the expelled middleman minority has later been invited back. But the political embarrassment of such a reversal of policy has often served as a deterrent. Catherine the Great circumvented her own ban on Jews entering Russia by a secret communication to one of her officials in Riga, saying that, in the interests of recruiting some merchant people, passports could be issued without mentioning their nationality or religion. Lest he miss the hint, she added a postscript in German: "If you don't understand me, it will not be my fault." In the wake of this communication, Jews began to be recruited. Other middleman minorities are middlemen not only in a purely economic sense, but also in social and political senses. Where a ruling class or race collects money from a large class of poorer people whom they do not wish to deal with directly, middleman minorities may take on the role of collecting rents or feudal dues for landlords or taxes for government, all roles virtually guaranteeing unpopularity. Even in a modern capitalist economy, an imperial race may prefer having someone else deal directly with foreign peoples whose languages and customs they are unfamiliar with, or whom they may find distasteful, or who simply do not seem worth the trouble of investing time and energy in getting to understand. Thus, the British East India Company dealt with the people of Bombay through Parsis as intermediaries in both tax collection and local marketing. Large European commercial firms in West Africa often used Lebanese traders as intermediaries in dealing with the native peoples, just as they used Indian traders as intermediaries in East Africa. On a more mundane level, middleman minorities have often been cultural intermediaries, facilitating economic transactions between individual members of other groups whose cultural differences made such transactions difficult to arrange. A 19th century example from Eastern Europe may be illustrative. A Ruthenian man was asked what he would charge to shingle a roof, but failed to respond. He was dismayed at the idea of undertaking such a contract, and refused to make any estimate. A Jew was then given the contract, and he came to the same man and offered him a fixed sum, which was accepted, for shingles and shingling, making, of course, his own profit on the business. Here, the Jewish contractor played a role familiar to middleman minorities around the world, serving as a cultural intermediary to get things done which were mutually beneficial to parties who were prevented by cultural barriers from making the same transaction themselves. Often such middlemen are blamed for exploitation, but the more fundamental problem is that the other transactors are in different cultural universes. The story of middleman minorities is not just an economic story. It is a social and political story as well. The racial, religious, linguistic, and other differences among the middleman minorities of the world makes the prevalence of a general social and political pattern in their relations with those around them all the more striking. The special hatred directed at middleman minorities has chilling implications that reach well beyond racial and cultural issues. That people who have created much of the economic progress of a community or a society should be hated by those who have been the passive beneficiaries of that progress says something about the irrational side of human beings in general, and in particular, their susceptibility to manipulation by skilled demagogues. However vicious the attacks on middleman minorities, those attacks seldom arise spontaneously. Such groups often live at peace with the surrounding society for generations or even centuries until some special events or movements come along to make them targets. Very often, the instigators of such disorders are business competitors, though sometimes they are simply political demagogues advancing their own careers, whether on the petty scale of community leaders who incite American blacks against Korean or Vietnamese store owners in ghetto neighborhoods, or at a national level, dictators like Idi Amin in Uganda or Hitler in Nazi Germany. Changing patterns. Whether migrations have taken place across land or water, there have been not only differences between countries of origin and countries of destination, there have also been differences among the various countries from which the immigrants originated. These latter differences have been reflected in different migration patterns. A very small percentage of the population of France migrated at all, even during the era of massive worldwide migrations, while nearly two-fifths of all the people born in Ireland were living outside Ireland by 1891. Differences among the migrants themselves have also been very large and very consequential. Even when different immigrant groups arrived at their various destinations equally destitute in financial terms, they often arrived with very different mixtures of skills, work habits, and propensities to save or to become alcoholic, violent, or criminal. Accordingly, immigrants from some nations have for centuries been more in demand than immigrants from other nations, and in some cases more in demand than the native population of the countries to which they went. In medieval Europe, for example, peasant farmers from the increasingly crowded lands of Western Europe were able to find more land at lower prices and with fewer feudal restrictions and obligations in the eastern part of the continent or in Ireland, because these peasants were in demand by the lords of Eastern Europe, where Western European farmers were preferred to the indigenous farmers because they offered such things as skills in drainage among the Flemish and different plowing techniques among the Germans. Landlords and rulers in Eastern Europe offered not only better economic terms for Western European peasants, but also greater personal freedom than that accorded to local peasants, and often the right to live under the laws they had been accustomed to in their lands of origin, rather than the unfamiliar laws of the new places of destination. Moreover, it was not only existing rulers who induced farmers to migrate. Potential conquerors likewise recruited supporters with promises of such benefits from military campaigns in Eastern Europe or in Ireland. International transfers of skills through migrations have been even more pronounced in urban communities. During the Middle Ages, most of the cities in Eastern Europe and the Balkans were populated primarily by foreigners with a variety of urban skills, rather than by the indigenous peoples who predominated in the countryside. Thus, cities in Albania were often populated primarily by Greeks, and cities in various parts of Eastern and Southeastern Europe by Germans. In a later era, the same pattern would be found in colonial Malaya, where the Chinese outnumbered the Malays in Singapore, which subsequently became an independent city-state because its continued inclusion after independence would have threatened the national hegemony sought by ethnic Malays. While some migrations have been from more advanced but more crowded countries, such as those of Western Europe, others have been from poorer countries to more prosperous countries. Even in the latter instances, however, seldom has it been the poorest of the poor who migrated, whether among the Irish, the Italians, or others. Those a notch or so higher on the economic scale could more readily gather together the passage money, and might be a notch or so higher because they had more initiative or more skills or experience. The wealthy aristocracy seldom saw a need to suffer either the rigors of the voyage or the dislocations of resettlement. But how many of the poorer classes could seek a better life abroad depended critically on how much the voyage cost. Late 20th century migrations to more developed countries have tended to be of people with more education, higher skills, and higher level job experience than the general populations of the countries from which they emigrated, whether these countries have been in Europe, Asia, Africa, or Oceania. More than one-fifth the migrants from all four regions to the United States in fiscal year 1989 were in professional or technical occupations, with an additional 10% or more being in executive, administrative, and managerial positions. An absolute majority of those migrating from India to the United States were in these high-level occupations. From the early 1970s through the mid-1980s, India sent more than 15,000 engineers and more than 15,000 physicians to the United States. From Latin America, however, people of much lower skill levels have come to the United States. These differences in skill levels among migrants from different parts of the world might be a function of the distance and expense required to reach North America from these regions. There have been large numbers of Asian lower-skilled emigrants, but their destinations have tended to be quite different. Contract laborers from the Indian subcontinent, for example, went overwhelmingly to the Middle East. In gross terms, however, migration has continued to be from poorer countries to more prosperous countries. American engineers and physicians do not migrate in large numbers to India. Within the European nations, the same general pattern of migrants from poorer countries going to richer countries has likewise been the rule. In 1990, for example, there were nearly twice as many people born in Spain living in France as people born in France living in Spain. West Germany, the industrial giant of the continent, had the most migrants within its borders before reunification, more than 5 million people, or more than one-third of all foreigners living in Europe. Conversely, the largest number of migrants in Europe came from poorer countries. More than 1 million were from Morocco, nearly 1.5 million from Iran, more than 1.5 million from Italy, and well over 2 million from Turkey. Like other migrants around the world, these did not settle randomly across the continent or evenly from one recipient nation to another. Italians were more than one-fourth of the foreigners living in Belgium and one-third of the foreigners living in Switzerland, but they were only a tenth of the foreigners in West Germany, where Turks were nearly one-third of the foreign-born population. In the Netherlands, Italian immigrants were outnumbered nearly 10-1 by Moroccans, even though there were more Italian immigrants than Moroccan immigrants in Europe as a whole. Migrants tend to differ not only from the general population of their respective countries of origin, they tend also to differ from the general population of the countries to which they are moving, as well as differing from migrants from other countries. The selective nature of many migrations is indicated by the fact that migrants often begin their life in a new land earning less than people of the same national, racial, or ethnic background who were born there. And yet, over a period of about 10 or 15 years, the migrants rise to higher income levels than their compatriots. Such patterns have been found among Black, white, and Chinese immigrants to the United States, and similar patterns have been found in Canada and Britain. Finally, the times themselves change, so that the conditions of migration, and consequently the sizes, origins, and destinations of migrations, also differ greatly. These differences in eras and peoples will be explored in turn. The purpose here will be not simply to assess the fates of the peoples who have migrated, but also to assess what impact their migrations have had on the history of the world. For what migrations have meant has been not merely a relocation of bodies, but more fundamentally, a redistribution of skills, experience, and other human capital across the planet. It is this process of cultural change which has transformed nations and continents. Changes in transportation. Transoceanic travel has become so much taken for granted that it is easy to overlook how recently in human history it came into existence and how hazardous it remained long afterward. Intrepid explorers like Columbus, or like Cheng Ho in China more than half a century before him, traversed thousands of miles of open water, as did the Vikings who landed in Greenland under Leif Erikson and others. But these were the feats of a few, not migrations of the many. Prior to Columbus, the great migrations were land migrations, often associated with conquest, or were migrations across the calm and enclosed waters of the Mediterranean or other bodies of water not comparable in size to the Atlantic or the Pacific. But even after the development of the science of navigation and the technology of shipbuilding permitted large-scale movements of people across the oceans, these movements remained hazardous for centuries. Accounts of the Atlantic crossing during the era of wind-driven ships depict the passengers packed into the ship's unhygienic holds as plagued with pox, blotches, and devoured by lice. These immigrant holds were often a scene of fearful cries in the night or during storms at sea. Sometimes smallpox, yellow fever, typhus, or dysentery struck and spread through the crowded ship. In 1738, only two of 15 ships arriving in Philadelphia disembarked most of their passengers in reasonable health. In 1749, an estimated 2,000 German emigrants died at sea. On one ship in 1745, only 50 out of 400 passengers arrived alive, and in 1752, only 19 out of 200. Between 1847 and 1851, 40 British emigrant ships alone went down in the Atlantic, with the loss of more than 1,000 lives. Moreover, even when ships arrived safely, many of those on board did not survive the rigors of the voyage. 17% of those on these crowded emigrant ships bound for America in the middle of the 19th century died either on the way or upon disembarking. These were particularly disastrous episodes, however. Still, scattered data suggests perhaps a 4-6% average mortality rate en route during the 18th century, which then declined to less than 1% by the 1860s, as the change from wind-driven ships to steamships drastically reduced deaths from both sinkings and disease. Steamships had far-reaching effects because they not only made voyages faster and cheaper, they made the timing of these voyages far more exact. Before, when sailing ships depended on the wind, which was variable, their arrivals and departures could never be scheduled with any precision. Emigrants had to gather in port cities to await the unpredictable arrival of wind-driven ships, not only draining the emigrants' meager sums of money for food and lodgings while waiting, but also subjecting them to different disease environments due to being in the midst of local strangers and other emigrants from other places, including other countries. The coming together of people from different disease environments, with different levels of resistance to one another's diseases, was likely to lead to more illnesses than normal, not only in port, but also in the crowded and unsanitary conditions prevailing aboard ship during a long voyage when food and water supplies might run low and produce weakened resistance. A study of more than 2,800 18th-century German emigrants with long waits in port before their voyage found mortality rates of 16% en route to America. The steamship changed all that. Where the time required to cross the Atlantic on a wind-driven ship ranged from 1 to 3 months, steam-driven ships crossed in a predictable 10 days. Now, emigrants could arrive in port for scheduled departures, sparing themselves the costs of long stays in dockside lodgings and the hazards of health and crime that these stays often involved. The much shorter voyage in larger ships likewise reduced both the costs and the hazards at sea, including the dangers of declining resistance to diseases when food and water ran low and exhaustion from the voyage took its toll. After the changeover from sailing ships to steamships during the decade of the 1860s, immigration grew both larger in volume and more varied in the origins of the emigrants, now that an ocean crossing was more widely available in more regions of the world and at lower costs. After the introduction of the steamship, the poorer peoples of Eastern and Southern Europe now began to predominate among those crossing the Atlantic, and emigration across the Pacific also accelerated. Prior to the steamship, transoceanic emigration meant largely the emigration of Europeans, mostly Northern and Western Europeans, across the Atlantic, usually to the United States. If emigration across the Atlantic on ships with sails was an ordeal, emigration across the much larger Pacific on such ships was still more so. From China or Japan to Hawaii was farther than from London to New York, and to the mainland of North America was more than 2,000 miles farther than that. The advent of the steamship enabled more Chinese and Japanese emigrants to join the streams of emigrants heading for the Western Hemisphere. It also promoted large-scale migration from the Asian mainland to the South Pacific islands of Fiji and to the vast coast of East Africa, where people from the Indian subcontinent went as either sojourners or settlers. Although Fiji is 7,000 miles from India, people of Indian ancestry eventually became half the population of the country. Steamships changed migration patterns in another way. In the era of ships with sail, poor emigrants were often carried on cargo ships, which had empty space heading west from Europe because the United States generally shipped bulky agricultural products to Europe in exchange for manufactured goods, which had much smaller bulk for a given value. Therefore, the cost of carrying people westward in what would otherwise be empty space, or space that would have to be filled with ballast, was very low, and the fares thus could be brought down to a level affordable to relatively poor people, provided that those poor people had access to ports which carried on trade with the United States. This meant that people in Northern and Western Europe, which had a large trade with the United States, were in a better position to find affordable means of crossing the Atlantic. Before the age of steam, destinations were constrained by the existing trade routes, since the migrants had to land wherever the cargoes landed. Steamships now made it economical to have ships designed and scheduled for passenger transport, making the Mediterranean as eligible as the Atlantic, and allowing the peoples of both regions to choose their own destinations in the new world of the Western Hemisphere. In short, wholly new patterns of international migration were made possible by the steamship. While Northern and Western Europe supplied the great majority of immigrants to the United States during the first century of its history, the 1880s was the last decade for which that was true. The rising proportions of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe became half of all immigrants to the United States in the 1890s and two-thirds during the first decade of the 20th century. Numbers also grew as origins changed in the wake of the steamship revolution. During the decade of the 1850s, 2.6 million immigrants arrived in the United States from around the world. By the 1880s, this had doubled to 5.2 million, and in the first decade of the 20th century, immigration to the United States reached its peak of 8.8 million people. The steamship also made seasonal migrations possible from Europe to the Western Hemisphere, leading to the phenomenon of Italian agricultural workers coming seasonally to Argentina and earning the nickname golondrinas, swallows. In a later era, a revolution in air transportation would change international migration patterns yet again. Even during the era of massive and growing transoceanic migrations, most European migration took place on land. Some was rural to urban migration, or interregional migration within the same country, and some migrations were from one part of Europe to another. Like intercontinental movements of people, these migrations within Europe were not random. Typically, they were from the poorer to the more prosperous areas, whether these were cities, regions, or nations. Geographically disadvantaged areas, whether barren mountains, agricultural regions with poorer fertility, or technologically backward parts of the continent, tended especially to send their peoples out in search of a better life elsewhere. Thus, there were outpourings of peoples from the mountains around Bohemia and from the Carpathians, the Pyrenees, France's Central Massif, and from the French Alps. Sometimes these were permanent relocations, and sometimes they were seasonal migrations of men from mountain villages. The less developed eastern provinces of 19th century Germany have been characterized as the great reservoir of German labor for the industrialized western regions of the country. Not all these people were ethnically German, however, some being Poles originating in Prussia. An estimated 250,000 Poles worked in the industrial Ruhr Valley of Western Germany. France was likewise a recipient of considerable immigration from other European countries. Thousands of foreigners, mostly Italians, worked in French coal mines, and altogether there were 400,000 foreign workers in the country as of 1900. In Europe during this era, as in the world at large during a later era, not all migrations were from poorer to richer countries, however. The more general pattern was from wherever the given people were less productive to wherever they were more productive. Therefore, many people with higher skills migrated to where those skills were in shorter supply and would be more highly rewarded. The German and Flemish farmers who migrated into Eastern and Central Europe were by no means the only examples. Many of the towns in medieval Albania had an absolute majority of Greeks living in them, while the hinterlands were mostly Slavic. Mining towns in many parts of Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe often had a population that was mostly German, reflecting the more advanced skills of Germans in mining. Railroads played a revolutionary role in land migrations, comparable to that of a steamship at sea. Indeed, railroads played a major role in promoting transoceanic trade and transoceanic migration as well. Bulky agricultural products, for example, became easier and cheaper to transport to and from ports in various countries by rail, thus creating international markets which brought American grain to Europe, displacing European peasants, many of whom then went to America. The Argentine Pampas likewise became a world supplier of wheat after rail lines connected its agricultural hinterlands to its own ports and thus to the port cities of the world. The coming of the railroad to Brazil likewise moved its huge coffee crops to its ports and from there to the ports of North America and Europe. More than that, however, rails moved landlocked peoples to the ports from which they could join the transoceanic migrations. Land migrations have been of historic proportions and enduring significance in the Western Hemisphere as well. The mass movement of Americans from their original settlements on the eastern seaboard across the vast plains to the Pacific coast not only expanded a nation, but also in the process transformed a people. The movement of blacks out of the South to the largely urban regions of the Northeast and Midwest in the 20th century was comparable in magnitude to the mass migrations across the Atlantic from Ireland or Germany at their peaks in the previous century. Even in the late 20th century, the migrations of Americans from one region of the country to another was greater than the migrations of all peoples from all foreign countries to the United States. The era of relatively inexpensive air travel, which began after World War II, created new changes in international migration patterns. Caribbean migrants of modest means not only could reach the United States readily, but could also choose their destinations within the United States, usually New York City and vicinity in the early post-war years, so as to skip over the South, which had racially discriminatory laws and practices that made it less attractive in the pre-civil rights era. Most of all, however, air travel brought the Western Hemisphere within reach of large numbers of emigrants from Asia. A negligible percentage of immigrants to the United States during most of its history, Asians became the largest single group of immigrants to the United States during the decade of the 1980s, when Vietnam and the Philippines together supplied more immigrants than all of Europe. More than transportation alone was involved in this historic shift, however. Changing laws and policies also opened up the country more fully to migrants from non-European nations. Migration policies. Few countries have had consistent immigration policies over long periods of time. Japan, however, is one that has. It has consistently kept immigrants out throughout its history. With a population of 124 million people, Japan permitted 1.2 million aliens to be legally registered in 1991, less than 1% of its population. Moreover, a significant fraction of these are people of Japanese ancestry from Brazil and other countries. In addition, more than 100,000 illegal migrant workers were estimated to be living in Japan. Few, if any, modern industrial nations have managed to remain as insulated from immigration as Japan and to retain as homogeneous a population. Even Australia, which once had a White Australia policy on immigration, let in non-white immigrants before and would later do so again, as well as letting in a variety of non-British Europeans all the while. By the late 20th century, Australia was one of the few countries in the world with relatively open immigration policies. In proportion to its existing population, Australia accepted double or triple the proportions accepted in Europe. Most nations have had varying policies over time on whom they would admit as immigrants, and some have had varying policies on whom they would allow to leave, and under what conditions. Both China and Japan prohibited all emigration, under pain of death, for centuries. The British attempted to prevent the emigration of British mechanics capable of carrying the techniques of its industrial revolution to other countries that might become rivals. In medieval Europe, serfs who left the land to which they were legally tied would be punished, sometimes with torture and mutilation. Countries preparing for war have prohibited the emigration of young men of military service age. Most prohibitions, however, have been against migrants seeking to enter. Some of these prohibitions have been heartrending in their effects, when refugees fleeing deadly dangers have been turned away at the borders or at the dockside. Thus, ships carrying Jewish refugees from Europe during the era of the Nazi persecutions were turned away from port after port. And a generation later, boat people fleeing the communist dictatorship in Vietnam and the killing fields of Kampuchea were turned away from Hong Kong and interned upon landing in Malaysia. The point here is not to evaluate migration policies politically or morally, but to see how they have changed historically and what the causes and consequences of those changes have been. One of the major changes from the 19th to the 20th centuries has been that nations which actively recruited immigrants and even subsidized their travel and resettlement in the 19th century began to restrict immigration, sometimes severely, in the 20th. New countries of the Western Hemisphere, such as Canada, Argentina, and Brazil, helped subsidize the settlement of immigrants in order to promote the economic development of their vast unoccupied lands and unused natural resources. The United States, as the world's leading recipient of immigrants, did not have to do that, but the American homesteading laws encouraged all who would settle on the land, whether immigrant or native. Policies welcoming immigrants have not been confined to frontier societies, however. Medieval rulers in Eastern Europe often welcomed settlements of German farmers, from whose productivity the rulers would benefit, both directly in taxes and by having the Germans' more advanced agricultural practices spread to others in their domains. Later, in the mid-18th century, Catherine the Great brought German farmers into Russia for the same reasons. The Ottoman Empire offered refuge to the Jews expelled from Spain in 1492, not for humanitarian reasons, but because of an anticipation that Jews would benefit the empire both economically and by the information they would bring about military technology, an anticipation that proved to be correct on both counts. Not all immigration policies have involved such rational calculations of national self-interest. Some policies have represented simply political expediency in giving in to the public passions of the moment. Many expulsions of productive groups, whether Jews in medieval Europe, Indian Chechars in Burma, Moriscos in Spain, or Indians and Pakistanis in Uganda, have represented these kinds of emotionally satisfying but economically self-damaging decisions. The growing restrictions on immigration in Western Hemisphere nations in the 20th century represented a variety of factors. As frontier conditions passed and the need to settle new regions subsided, the problems and potential dangers of continued unrestricted immigration prompted first the United States and Canada, and later countries in Latin America, to begin restricting either the numbers or the origins of immigrants, or both. The massive unemployment of the Great Depression of the 1930s made more potential job seekers unwelcome. Restrictions on the national or racial origins of immigrants fell into disrepute after World War II, which discredited the racist doctrines associated with Hitler and the Nazis. The White Australia policy and the stringent American restrictions on immigration from Asia both fell under criticism. Australia, aware that its small population made it vulnerable to invasion during the Second World War, began encouraging immigration from around the world in the post-war era and subsidized many of the immigrants. In 1965, the United States produced a new immigration law, which no longer restricted immigration from Asia, so that Asians grew to become the most numerous of immigrants to the United States, with Latin Americans a close second. Together, Asia and Latin America supplied three-quarters of all immigrants to the United States during the decade of the 1980s. The acculturation of migrants. In addition to understanding the settings in which the various immigrants' cultures have evolved, it is necessary to understand the new countries in which these cultures are to function. The two things interact in various ways. The histories of particular racial and ethnic groups, and of particular nations and civilizations, can shed much light on the question as to what extent peoples carry enduring cultural patterns within themselves, and the extent to which they are shaped, or their fates determined, by the actions of others in the society in which they currently find themselves. The implications of the answers to such questions are momentous, not only intellectually, but also as a matter of immediate practical public policy in countries around the world. With statistical differences being so widely equated with moral inequities, empirical evidence on the persistence of cultural patterns within the same group from one country to another affects not only empirical questions, but moral and political questions as well. When we study the history of Germans in Russia, in Paraguay, in Australia, and in other countries, do we find a set of occupational patterns, lifestyle patterns, and other patterns common to Germans in these very disparate societies? And do these patterns persist across the generations as they do across political borders? If so, how can such results be reconciled with the assumption that statistical disparities within a given nation demonstrate the effects of that society? While we need not go to the extreme of attributing the fate of immigrants to the way they are treated by society, neither can we ignore completely the fact that there is an interaction. Whether it is the internal cultural patterns of a group or the surrounding social and natural environment which predominates at a given time and place can only be determined by an examination of those times and places. Moreover, neither the culture of the immigrants nor the social or even natural environments around them remain fixed over time. Immigrants from different countries have tended to assimilate to the culture in their new societies to very different degrees, the German culture tending to be particularly tenacious, for example, while Scots have been readily absorbed into English-speaking cultures in the United States or Australia. However, even for a given immigrant group, how rapidly they acculturate has varied according to whether they perceive the surrounding culture as desirable or undesirable. The Irish Catholic Church, for example, worked hard to assimilate Irish immigrants to American society in the 19th century, but worked equally hard to maintain a cultural separation of Irish immigrants from Argentine society at the same time. The endurance of cultural patterns among emigrants varies both with the particular group and with the societies in which they settle. It has not been uncommon, for example, for the German language to remain the primary means of communication, including education, among German immigrants and their descendants a century after they immigrated to Russia, Argentina, or Australia. Yet Germans were more willing to assimilate in the United States than in other societies whose cultures they did not find as attractive. The overseas Chinese also acquired at least the outward veneer of American society more readily than they did the culture of colonial Malaya or post-colonial Malaysia. Immigrants from India and their descendants living in Fiji also made no effort to become like the Fijians, even when their local culture evolved away from that of India. Yet immigrants from India have blended into late 20th century American society so well that they are little noticed as a separate group, even though they were, by 1980, more numerous than Koreans or Vietnamese living in the United States. Some of the most dramatic examples of cultural changes in a relatively short time have been among the immigrants to the United States from Eastern and Southern Europe and their descendants. Although notoriously uneducated and illiterate during the era of mass immigration, and indeed often resistant to education for their children, Southern and Eastern Europeans eventually became, by 1980, as educated as other Americans and as well represented in occupations requiring education, such as professional, technical, and managerial positions. This entailed great differences between generations of these groups in education, occupations, and languages spoken. The greater incidence of multiple ethnic ancestries reported by younger members of these groups suggests a growing amount of intermarriage, one of the key indicators of acculturation. Not all statistics on intermarriage are necessarily evidence of either acculturation or assimilation, however. When Irish immigrants in post-war Australia married women who were Australian citizens, these statistical intermarriages were often marriages to Australian citizens of Irish ancestry. Not all cultural interaction resulting from migrations are one way. Just as the larger society surrounding the immigrants may influence their culture, so can the immigrant culture affect the larger society. Thus, the Spanish spoken in Argentina has acquired Italian words from the immigrants from Italy, while such American cultural features as kindergarten, Christmas trees, and hamburgers derived from German immigrants. Migrating peoples can have a cultural impact on other peoples, not only directly, but indirectly. The mass migrations of Magyar invaders who settled the Hungarian plains during the Middle Ages split the vast areas of Eastern Europe where Slavic peoples lived. After the Slavs were thus separated from one another, their cultural developments diverged, as indicated by the separate Slavic languages that developed in different regions. The immigrant groups covered in the chapters that follow cannot, of course, represent all of the sweeping array of cultural patterns in the world. Nevertheless, they are sufficiently different from one another to provide some important insights into the role of culture in the economic and social fates of peoples, whether in their own countries or in a range of different countries to which they migrate. Because these groups have often settled in the same countries abroad, the very different patterns of their histories in these countries adds another dimension to the role of culture in history.